somebody else probably just wrote it. Can you have 10 years?
Good afternoon, everyone.
I'm better and I'm better and
my name is Mike Herhold. I am the Vice President of the Board of the First Friday Club of Greater Akron. Welcome to today's program. Our topic for today is Common Good, Uncommon Excellence, Service to the Poorest of the Poor, with President of the Catholic Relief Services, Catherine Wu. Please silence your cell phones so that we can all enjoy today's program. On your tables, you'll find white cards on which you can write down questions for Catherine, for Carolyn. After the talk, we will have a short announcement break and collect those cards and have a question and answer session also. At this time, it's my pleasure to introduce First Friday Club board member Les Radmany with our opening invocation.
Since I have the microphone, I have three things that I want to address before praying. First of all, Phil Maynard and I sincerely want to thank the sponsor of this program. It balances our budget, to be honest with you. I also hope that you'll continue to support this effort, even if Phil Maynard isn't asking. Second point, speaking about Phil, where's Phil? Phil invited all of you. What happened was is that Phil sponsored somebody for the National Association of Fundraising Executives local chapter. They have an annual luncheon and they honor different people that have been involved in philanthropy. He sponsored somebody for the award this year and felt he was kind of obligated to go. He may even be introducing that person. Third thing, I brought two hats with me today. Okay? Now, notice the one hat, though. Yes, it says Notre Dame Irish, but it says Irish. And that made me think. I really want to say that I want to wish the best of luck to the Akron Irish, St. Vincent's, and then the Hoban football and soccer team, and the Walsh Jesuit girls soccer team. I think that... All of those are in playoffs right now. This reminded me of my old football coach, thinking about football and playoffs, at Hoban High School. His name was Bob Zupke. He told us that when we went to chapel before games, that the only thing that we should be praying for was that everybody played their best and that nobody gets hurt. We were not supposed to pray to win. I only broke that... I won't say when I broke it, but I only did that one time in my career as a football player. Actually, that, I believe, as I thought about it, is kind of a life lesson about prayer. We need to seek God's will, not our own, and find peace in the answers that he gives us. In the Holy Cross newsletter from Ghana, there was a Ghana saying that they printed this month. When you're young, you take from the pot. As we grow older, we're supposed to put into the pot. My prayer today, dear Lord, let us be inspired by Dr. Wu's presentation. Help us better understand our responsibility to put into the pot. And by Dr. Wu's transition, by her transition, putting into the pot as her new vocation. Now my second hat is a different Notre Dame hat. And it's got a little bit more class. And I only brought it up here so that I could tip my hat to Dr. Wu. Aww.
Thank you, Les. Always entertaining. And now I would like to introduce, our speaker is First Friday Club of Greater Akron board member and executive director of the Catholic Commission of Summit County, Diane Zabaznik.
Good afternoon. Dr. Carolyn Wu is president and CEO of Catholic Relief Services, the official international humanitarian agency of the Catholic community in the United States. She came to CRS in January of 2012 after a distinguished academic career. CRS was founded in 1943 by the U.S. bishops to serve survivors of World War II in Europe. Since then, it has become one of the world's largest and most respected international relief agencies each year, reaching more than 130 million people in nearly 100 countries. Dr. Wu, representing CRS, was featured in Foreign Policy magazine as one of the 500 most powerful people on the planet and one of only 33 in the category of a force for good. Before coming to CRS, Dr. Wu served from 1997 to 2011 as Dean of the University of Notre Dame's Mendoza College of Business. During her tenure, the Mendoza College was frequently recognized as the nation's leading business school in ethics education and research, and received top ranking in 2010 and 2011 for its undergraduate business program from Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. Prior to the University of Notre Dame, Dr. Wu served as Associate Executive Vice President for Academic Affairs at Purdue University. She was born and raised in Hong Kong and immigrated to the United States to attend Purdue University, where she received her BS, MSIA, and PhD degrees, and became a member of its faculty. Her teaching, research, and administrative leadership has been recognized through the Best Paper Awards by the Academy of Management, selection as one of 40 Young Leaders of American Academia by Change Magazine, a distinguished alumna and honorary alumna by Purdue University and the University of Notre Dame, as well as by the conferral of honorary doctorates from Providence College, University of St. Francis, Lewis University, as well as the University of Notre Dame. She was the first female dean to chair the accreditation body for business schools and directed its initiative for peace through commerce. From 2004 to 2010, Dr. Wu served on the board of directors for Catholic Relief Services. She currently serves on the board of directors for AON Corporation, NiSource, Catholic Charities USA, Aileron Foundation, the Board of Regents at the University of Portland, the Board of Governors at the University of Notre Dame, Australia, Archdiocese of Baltimore Independent Child Abuse Review Board, and many others. She also serves as a member of the Executive Committee of the Advisory Board Fuel Up to Play 60, which is sponsored by the National Football League and the National Dairy Council. She also helped to launch the Principles for Responsible Management Education for the United Nations Global Compact Program and the Diversity Advisory Committee of KPMG. Dr. Wu is married to Dr. David E. Bartkus, and they have two sons, Ryan and Justin. Please welcome Dr. Wu.
All right, we're going to show some slides and so on. Before I do that, just a little bit more light for just a few more minutes. Just want to say thank you for this invitation. I've done a number of First Friday Club lunches, and I often make fun of them. They're seldom on Fridays. Cleveland is on Thursday, and I was told that so that they could have more menu options than just fish for them. And I was making fun of the Akron Club. I said, this is not First Friday. And they said, well, we made the adjustment for you, so I'm not going to make fun of it. I truly feel like I'm with family when I'm at these gatherings. First of all, the Diocese, Archdiocese of Cleveland, Akron, as part of it, have been so supportive of CRS work. I feel like I'm among sort of brothers and sisters. I went to a school in Hong Kong, a school called Maryknoll Sisters Schools, and the Maryknoll Sisters were formed by the Dominican Sisters. So we have two tables there of our Dominican Sisters and their schools. Notre Dame, as you heard, also represented here, and feel very welcomed by it. My former advisory council member, Terry, and his wife, Joyce Nolan, are here too. And most important, you know, sometimes I'm almost in a city a day. It's easy to lose track of people. But whenever I'm in these gatherings, I'm reminded that this is the church. This is actually the people who work for the vitality of the church and how we pass on our faith to the next generation. And it's always a tremendous privilege. I just want to say an introduction. Mike said, you know, I was acknowledged, I guess, honored, cited, whatever, as one of the 500 most important people on the planet, actually, and I think that's really, really cool. It's just that when I received that honor, I was only 1 year into my job, so clearly, you know, that honor was not for me. It's really for 70 years of work of Catholic Relief Services out in the world. The work that it does to serve people anywhere on the planet, actually, who are in deep need, and I'll say a little bit more about that, but to be willing to go there, to serve on the basis of need, not creed, we serve everyone. As we say, we serve not because they are Catholic, but because we are Catholic, and the gospel, God sent us to serve. God made a promise that he would never leave us orphans. And I don't know whether God has appeared to you in person lately, but for me, God always appeared in another person, a person who showed up at the right time to help you through a situation, people who give you a hand, people who inspire you, people who take you through. So I think that when God doesn't leave us orphans, he gives us each other. We are not accidents to each other. People come into our lives and we go into their lives. I think that's what that award is for. I think that's what our work is about. And also, I don't think it's just about service, but it's about a voice. It's a voice of the very poor who have no voice. They have no seat at the table. So we are the eyes. We are the shoulders who have been in their midst. We see their suffering. We have been with them together. We know in the field what is working, what is not, what people's lives are like. And we bring those stories and bring those issues and causes back to the United States. We educate Catholics in the United States, but we also educate Congress. We frequently go to the Hill and talk to our political representatives about what's going on in the world. And it's really for that award, for this body of work, that that award is given. And in the end, CRS is not about me or my organization. CRS is actually about you. CRS is the official agency for the U.S. Catholics. It was started by the American bishops. It represents American Catholics out in the world. A lot of times they cannot even pronounce our names. They've never heard of us before, but they would say, oh, those are the American Catholics. And that's how we do our witness, is by our work, by our service. I'm reminded when I visited Iraq a year ago, and we visited the Yazidis. You might recall the Yazidis more than a year ago were displaced by ISIS. ISIS took over. They went to this mountain called Mount Sinjar, actually, and they are very, very ancient sect, the Yazidis. They're not quite Muslims. They're definitely not Christians. In their religion, they have angels. They're very peaceful and a very ancient sect. But they were targeted by ISIS for elimination. They went to this mountain, Mount Sinjar, and they were encircled by ISIS, actually, and that's where the U.S. actually first got involved in the bombing, and it is to free them and to take them out. We were visiting with the Yazidi communities who were displaced from that part of Syria into northern Iraq in the area held by the Kurdish troops, an area called Erbil. When I asked the Yazidi woman, what do you know about CRS? And she said, not much. We have never heard of you before, but you must be givers. Givers. And that is good to be known as that, that we give in the name of our religion, actually. And I mention this because right now the troops are trying to retake, the Kurdish troops are trying to retake Mount Sinha and to move the ISIS back. So that's a little bit of the world that we're in. So think about Ceres, actually, we're 73 years old. We're actually kind of like the Red Cross of the American Catholic Church. In a year, we serve anywhere from about 85 million to 130 million people in your name. It depends on the emergencies that we are addressing. One third of our work is still very much emergency, and then two thirds of our work is long-term development. We're in 100 countries. We're in countries that you would never go on for vacation. So as I mentioned, we were in Iraq. We were actually 12 miles away from ISIS-held territories. We are in Central Africa region, in South Sudan, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan. We're in Gaza. We are in the Middle East. Some pretty tough countries. And why do we go to those countries? And because poverty and conflict never happen in really beautiful countries. I mean, in save and hotels with five stars and, you know, hot water and so on. You know, the type of conflicts that we walk into and deal with and serve, these are pretty rough places. But it's our calling to do that. Let me just start on the PowerPoint and with some videos. I was going to talk about common good and common excellence, which is the whole idea of how you have to be excellent in the work to serve the poor, because the poor doesn't get a lot, but they get us. And therefore, we have to bring our best game. But somebody told me that our colleagues from Cleveland are here, and some of them may have heard that presentation. So today I'm actually kind of going to take you around the world with us and our emergency work, just for you to have a sense of what we do. You can see in our tagline there at the bottom, if you can see it, is faith, action, results, which is what we're about. Our work is done because of our faith. The faith compels us to act, particularly to serve those who are poorest, the most vulnerable. And it is not enough just that we are busy and that we do work, but we have to hold ourselves accountable for whether the results are real, whether people's lives are really better, whether there's impact, and whether that work can be sustained. I also want to mention a little bit about the CRS. You can see the flame, which is to the left of CRS. And that symbol, nobody knows what it stands for. We had a branding consultant who actually suggested we get rid of it. And we said no. And actually, what do you think it stands for? It stands for, it looks like a flame. It looks like water drop. It looks like a seed. It looks like a womb. And in fact, we do work in all of those areas, whether it's water, whether it is seed, whether it's maternal health, child health, and of course, to bring light into a world which is really dark. But it actually is not any of those that give rise to this symbol. It's actually the stopping point of a little animation, and the animation is about a dove. And when the dove, you know, sort of put the wings above here, it freezes, and so it became that symbol. And of course, the dove is the Holy Spirit. And so in a business school, I trained a lot of branding consultants too, and I said, no, we're not getting rid of this brand, just because you don't know what it is. Okay, so a little bit, all the colored areas of the world are areas that we work in, or we have programs in, or we support programs. In them, you can see China in the mustard yellow. We actually don't work in China, but we support Caritas Hong Kong, which does work in China. This map is a little bit outdated, but it gives you a sense. We are almost in every continent. We increase or decrease the size of our programs based on need. We started heavy in Eastern Europe. We sort of went away from Eastern Europe. We are now back in Eastern Europe because of what is happening in Europe. In total, over 100 countries now. Sometimes it goes between about 95 to 105, 85 to about 130 million people, depending on the programming, and a budget of about $650 million to about $950 million. So it's a very large agency. We have 5,000 colleagues around the world, and we actually work with 1,200 partner organizations. About 600 of those is the Catholic Church. So we also have a tremendous impact on the programming by the global Catholic Church. What I'm going to do to you, with you today is just to go around the world a little bit to review some of the major emergencies that we are working on in your name, just so that you have some sense of how pervasive and what those are. The first one, of course, is Europe, and you see in the map mostly Southern Europe. This is what you're hearing the most in the news nowadays. As you know, there's a lot of people who are displaced. The number from the UN is about 60 million people who are displaced. They're displaced from places such as Iraq and Syria, which of course, all the bombing which is going on and the conflict, from Afghanistan, from Yemen. There's also displaced people a few years ago moving from Central America up north. There's also displaced people in Colombia, South America. And so around the world, it's the largest number of people who are displaced. 20 million of them are moving across borders. About 40 million, 38 million are internally displaced, which means they may go from Eastern Ukraine to Western Ukraine because of the conflict that involves the Russians and the rebels. These are internally displaced people. They're people who go from one part of Syria to another part. But nevertheless, they're also sort of out of their home and out of sometimes farms and so on where they make their livelihoods. And so Europe, we're doing a lot of work actually serving the people who are now immigrating to Europe. We think right now there are about 800,000 people in Europe. And where we help is like with Caritas Greece, Caritas Albania, Caritas Macedonia, Caritas Serbia. These are all the Caritases who are all of a sudden flooded with people who come through. We even give donation to Caritas Germany because they are settling quite a number of these individuals. When they're moving through these countries, we provide things such as food, sanitation. Just bear in mind, a lot of times, several hundred people, 700,000 people appear, and there's no bathroom facilities. We deal with things such as basic health care, to set up a clinic, a temporary clinic for people to be checked, for children to be checked. Non-food items, personal items that they would need, places to take showers, hot meals so that they could continue on the journey. And what we also provide, for example, is information. Legal information, for example. When they're moving through from country to countries, they're not very aware totally about the immigration policies, their own human rights, and we also provide translation. So you could imagine these people, they're just walking from one place to another. They don't know the language. They don't know necessarily where they are headed. So that's Europe, and just like I said too, we are further north in the Ukraine. We work with Caritas Ukraine, which before the breakout of this whole situation with Russia, Caritas Ukraine has a budget of about $1 million, and now it's operating at $10 million. And the funding, the training, the program design, and so on, CRS works very closely with our partners to make sure that they are up and running on that. In fact, I have a video on the people moving through. Let me see if I could get to the video. Okay. I think this is a good one.
Homeless people, they have exactly the same needs like anybody else of us. And they are humans, and our responsibility as humans is to take care of them. The They're, of course, naturally tired and exhausted, but some of them are like happy because they are here. They managed to get up to this point, but also they're trying to find the hope to continue their trip. They face huge, huge humiliation and danger back in their countries. Nobody would take such a risk to travel unless there is something horrible behind them.
Life in Iraq is very difficult. I want a job and I want to life beautiful for me and my family.
Any individual country in Serbia or any others that their people are turned away, they cannot do it themselves. And the influx is constant, and the aid is necessary. CRS, with its partner Caritas, we are providing hygiene supplies. On the northern of Serbia, we are providing temporary shelter. We have a doctor who is providing medical care. And we have also interpreters for Arabic language available. I lived in Bosnia during the war, 1992-1995. And mostly I'm remembering things that were nice when people were nice to me or when something nice happened to me. And they will probably remember segments of this. And maybe this nice segment they, in their lives, what they received in Serbia, will help them to somehow polish all the wounds that they have. Like they will try to probably remember only the best things.
There's nothing worse than having to manage your own technology. But in any case, I just give you a snippet of the work in one country. You can see a lot of these people who are displaced, they're actually very much middle class. It's just that their neighborhoods have been bombed and destroyed. They still face active firepower. And of course, always the concern about ISIS moving closer and so on. And of course, even within Syria, there are many rebel groups and the government and all those conflicts. There are about 4 million people now who have been displaced from Syria. Here, you know, before they came to Europe, they actually went to the Middle East. You can see Lebanon, Jordan, their neighbors. And now 25% of the population in these countries are actually the Iraqi and the Syrian refugees. It actually overwhelms the host countries. As you can imagine, they're not set up to deal with this type of numbers. You also deal with the issues that this could create a lot of instability, a lot of resentment. It sets up vacuums where terrorist groups could also operate there. You see, for example, in Lebanon now, there's some bombings from different groups. And these countries become very destabilized. In Jordan, in Lebanon, in Turkey, CRS has been running programs. Some of those programs are, by the way, this is 4 years now in the running. The programs include how do we educate children. Children who are in a camp gets education, but a lot of families do not choose to go into camps. Camps are not the safest environments. So a lot of people choose to stay with a relative. And what that means may be that they're allowed to sort of live in a corner of a very small apartment. I mean, people don't have big homes in these areas. They don't have American-style houses. People have apartments. And so they have relatives who kind of stay and they have a corner. And these relatives, you know, to stay for 2 months is okay, but you have to imagine now these are 4 years. These people who newly arrived, they're terrified. They don't go out. They don't let their children go out. Their children are not properly enrolled in schools. It's hard to make a living. It's impossible to get medicine. They cannot access their pension, their savings. It's a very difficult life. So our work there deals with education. For example, we work with the Catholic schools to run a second shift. The school buses take home the regular children, and then they bring home the children of these refugees to start shift 2 from 3 to 7 o'clock. The children get a meal, and this is called informal education because we're not totally certified to do certain things. But the key is to allow a 5th grade child to stay in the 5th grade curriculum, a 6th grade child, so that someday, hopefully, there will be integration. And when there is integration, they won't be far behind. Education is also very important for what we call protection. These are also environments where particularly human trafficking, is very easy to happen. And school is one way to provide a structure so that you could keep track of the children and you know who is missing. And of course, the number of people we serve is just a fraction of the number of people who need this. And of course, also healthcare. And now we're also starting a lot of children's psychosocial support centers. And that is, research has showed us that children, when they're under trauma, they actually, their brain structure is changed. They also have stress hormones. And their stress hormones could actually restructure where their brain will develop and where it will not develop. There is an estimate that some of these IDP situations, children will grow up in camps, an average of about 17 years. And of course, the world should be very concerned about a generation of tens of millions of children who will now grow up in camps without education. And the question is, what will they become? And so these are just some of the issues related to refugees, related to sort of how do we serve them, what is it like. By the way, the psychosocial support uses puppets, Muppets, which are developed by Jim Hansen's group.
Oops. I don't think I'm doing something right. Okay. I need my person to...
Yes. What are you trying to get to?
I should get the next slide.
All right.
So this is the next slide.
All right, this is the next slide.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, these are just some more pictures. The picture with the man and the woman is actually in Gaza. It was during the bombing last year. And whenever there was a ceasefire, somehow Syrians all of a sudden show up. We organize distribution. As you can see, some of these non-food items include fuel, as in kerosene, and some type of supplies and a yellow can. I don't know what it is, but a stove to cook in. You know, these are the things that we provide. They are not low budget items, but it's what people need. The picture with the two little girls is in Iraq, and it's the first picture that the Pope tweeted. And it was a CRS picture, so we're very proud of that. I think I'm going backwards. Okay. Here is now a different part of the country. We're moving to probably, here is West Africa. I'm going to do this. Here is West Africa and the Central Africa Republic, what is called CAR. I want to show you this because the Pope is scheduled to visit CAR this month. He's going to Uganda and he's going to CAR. CAR is a highly violent country at this point. There is a civil war going on with the former president and the former vice president representing different tribes. And actually, aid group could not operate for a month in the central capital of Central Africa region. And here, you know, there's an African proverb that says, when elephants fight, the weed get trampled, the soil get trampled. And that's actually the case, highly violent. And here we're dealing with people losing their shelter, the issue of food, the issue of how do we stabilize the country when there is so much conflict. Here we actually have a program which is very, very different, highly recognized, and it's an interfaith religion project where we bring together the Catholic leaders, the Muslim leaders, and the Protestant leaders. And we have given training to over 800 of these three faiths, leaders from these three faiths. We have taken the highest level people from these three faiths to the U.S. to meet with the USCCB last year. I bet they will be here too this year and to go into the U.S. Congress to educate Congress about what is going on. Interfaith, not just dialogue, but cooperation is very, very important. So that whatever may be a civil conflict, maybe an ethnic conflict, maybe a tribal conflict, does not become a religious conflict. And it is very important for religious leaders to call for peace, to stand up for each other, to send the message of brotherhood and solidarity and unity.
And more we need to do work like this. This work of the Interfaith Coalition in Central Africa is also funded by the Islamic Relief as well as the Latter-day Saints. And so is multiple religions coming together to deal with this whole issue of how do we create peace. We also created a program which is an FM radio station in order to broadcast positive news, but also to give early warning signals when there are dangers in particular areas. So here is Central Africa region. Of course, there will be the issues of food and agricultural livelihood and so on. Ethiopia, of course, at the Horn of Africa, a country which has done an extremely good job in the last 20 years in terms of growing. The growth rate of about 6 to 7% is a very stable country now, and doing well, except that now is facing two cycles of drought, which means it didn't get two cycles of rain, which means that food insecurity, they don't like the word famine, which means that there would be food insecurity issues. The government at first would say 2 million people would not have food, and now revised this estimate to 8 million people. We think it's closer to 20 million people and children who will not have enough food. And this problem will manifest itself starting from about at the first part of the year, January, February, all the way to October, until they could get the next harvest. We're doing a lot of work of clearly providing food is one of those, but also providing seeds so that they could start planting because they didn't get any seeds from their harvest. Food prices now have gone up by 70%, 70, the price of lentils, which is one of their basics. Livestock has been dying because there's not enough feed. So we also provide feedstock. We also now from experience know that when there is not enough food, there'll be severe stunting and malnutrition, and it will also compromise health programs such as vaccinations for cholera and also malaria prevention. And so a country which has done well, but this next year, maybe about 20 million people who would not have enough food. And this comes from the fact that they're very dependent on rain-fed agriculture, and rain-fed agriculture depends on rain, and there is some climate change. Mali is another West Africa country which is going through major conflict. And whenever there's conflict, there will be food issue, and there will be displacement of people. I have a lot more, so I'm going to go quicker. Nigeria is probably the concentration of the most number of very poor Africans. It's a country that, by and large, has done very well. Half of the country is actually Catholic. But what you see in Nigeria now, all of you have heard about this, Boko Haram. Boko Haram kills a lot of people. That whole northeast area where it is, it has killed just 10,000 people in 2014 alone. And so our work there is actually to rebuild the communities, not directly in the area where Boko Haram is, but in the ring of areas, the whole issue of food, the whole issue of health, the whole issue of restarting agriculture. And here is not because of the Nigerian people, but here is really a jihadist group and the damage that it could do. Next. West Africa, the three countries of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, of course, is Ebola. A year ago this time, we were very nervous about Ebola. You might remember that. I think there was a case in the U.S., in Texas, and there was another case. Ebola is highly infectious. There are 30,000 cases and about 10,000 deaths. So it's a disease which also has an infection which has very high mortality rate. I'm happy to report that Sierra Leone and Liberia now are supposed to be Ebola free. There are no new cases reported. So it just happened within 1 year, and I would say overall heroic effort on the people who are responding to this. We were actually downsizing
in these three countries. We were consolidating the three country staff into one country. Ebola erupted and we had to recruit and increase staff. And so I just want to ask you to imagine, those of you who are HR directors, how do you increase staff? And just not any staff. You have to have staff who has experience and the skills who will raise their hands to go to an Ebola active country. Our work continues in these countries now. During the period when the infection was growing and very active, the job that we took on was communication. We used radio campaigns, education. We went door to door to educate people. Triage, we provided clinics to be able to check people out. Not everyone has Ebola. Some people just have a fever. There's still malaria. There's still babies to be delivered. So we need triage situation. We also need to provide money for equipment, those suits that you saw, those yellow suits, as well as, you know, we provided several hundred motorcycles just for people to go out into communities to be able to do the education. There is a very important Catholic hospital, St. Joseph's Hospital. You may remember there were 7 staff that died from Ebola, including the top person and the medical director, and they had to close. And it had to reopen. And so what did we need to do in order to reopen the hospital so that people have care not just for Ebola, but for other diseases also? They're orphans from this whole infection. How do we handle the orphans? And one of the jobs that we did, and training healthcare workers for them to know how to diagnose and how to treat, how to handle Ebola patients. And one of the most significant jobs that we took on was safe burials. We found that infection continues, pass on from person to person because of the burial practices. There's a lot of handling of a diseased corpse, and it's a local practice. There's a lot of stroking, there's a lot of kissing, there's a lot of sleeping right next to the person who has died, and that's how the infection continues. The government came in and we just removed the dead body, so the family started not reporting. Family members who have died because of the fairly insensitive way. And so CRS had the job, when there is a death in that family, to go in, be the first line, to counsel the family, to talk to them about how to handle their loved one in very respectful way, but in very firm ways, and how we would handle the body, and there would be safe burial, there would be respectful burials, there would be a marker, actually more respectful than otherwise, and then the government follows. Those are highly infectious situations. And so that's West Africa and Ebola, and isn't it wonderful that the whole outbreak has come to a stop? And this is actually a contribution to the world. As we can see, it doesn't take much for a disease to go from one part of the world to another. So that's Ebola. South Sudan, civil war. It was saved. Startup of South Sudan is the newest nation in the world and started in 2011. But since 2013, a lot of civil strife between different factions, and also a war between South Sudan and Sudan over oil pipelines and so on. And again, people displaced, they're chased from their land, they cannot farm. If they cannot farm, it means they cannot eat. And so all the issues related to that, as well as health, as well as children's well-being. So we're there. South Sudan is actually the second largest program, single country program for Catholic Relief Services. Next one is Central America. Again, a year ago, remember the influx of undocumented migrants from Central America into the USA. There were pull factors and push factors. Pull factors was the perception that the United States was opening its gates. The push factors are really the causes of why people chose to leave, and it was really extreme poverty and extreme violence. And so our work there is of three kinds and a big body of work. One is youth, our youth builder program that work with youth at risk. They're 14 to 24 years old.
Their kids are not in school, which means that they tend to be recruited by gangs or already in gangs, but sort of like minor participants. And so we give them 400 hours of training, curricula, vocation, and life skills. And our first pilot was 5,000 students with a success rate of 85%. And the 85% means they either went back to school, or they hold down a job, or they start a new business. We recruited over 200 local businesses to employ them as interns. Our next phase for that program is 10,000 youth, and we're getting ready. Really, the third phase is to serve 100,000 youth in that part of Central America. That gives you some sense of the size of our programs. Agriculture is a way to allow the rural population to have a good livelihood so that they don't move into the urban areas and become the urban and unemployed poor, and their children join gangs. So rural prosperity is very important to us. And just to give you a sense of one of the programs we are working on, a five-year program in El Salvador, a large grant where the objective is to revitalize the whole cacao production. Cacao is chocolate. It is native to El Salvador, but it has gone out of production for 100 years. This grant requires us to engage 11,000 farmers across the country to grow cacao, because it's a very high value crop, as many of you like chocolate. And in the process of, you know, re-engaging farmers for cacao production, we have to generate 26,000 jobs. Okay, gives you some sense of the type of challenge we take on, and here's where we go for impact and sustainable benefits. Because once there are jobs, industry, farmers are doing well, you can address the issue of poverty and violence. Our first year in, we signed up 3,000 farmers who started planting, and there's a lot of skill transfer and development in doing this type of work, but we ran into a drought. So we learned a very important lesson, and that is we need to also address the availability of water. We need to take on the challenge of what is the water infrastructure for the whole country. And you can tell that solutions to these problems is not just engineering in nature. A lot of it is financial, capital, social, and in nature. So that gives some sense of the work in Central America. Nepal is the earthquake that happened several months ago, about 6 months now, and we are now at the point beyond emergency into development. Rebuilding housing, for example, is very important to us, and livelihood. So I want to show you a little video of Nepal. Okay. I think this is...
Nepal is a developing country, and in these specific circumstances it makes it even more complex to provide assistance in the appropriate way because of the bad infrastructure exacerbated by the earthquake because of the difficulties reaching these remote areas. The roads are extremely bad, makes the commute and the transportation very difficult. It takes time to get the supplies in. Each family receives iron sheets to cover their roofs, together with a set of blankets and mats, buckets and soaps to help them with their hygiene needs throughout the month, as well as toolkits to help them repair their homes. We are racing against time because the monsoon, the rain season is coming. It is really important for us to get as many humanitarian supplies in as fast as possible before the rain sets in so that we can help the needy population here in the area.
Normally during the monsoons, we have a lot of landslide and the flood. The landslide will be comparatively higher this year because many hills and mountains are weakened by the earthquake. So there are places we are responding, which is beyond the excess. For example, in Gorkha, there we can go on foot by vehicle. We have to take helicopters. So it's very far away. It's beyond the Himalaya and some places. Those high hills we are supporting also is very remote.
Cirrus has had to come up with creative ways to reach people. Tractors allow for transportation materials on these roads that even a 4x4 can't get through. And in the case of the high Himalayan mountains, we've hired trekkers who are experienced Nepalese who have a business of taking people to some of the most remote places on Earth. And we've hired them to adapt their skill sets to this emergency response. There are numerous and constant challenges in trying to reach people. And it just gives you a sense of how difficult this geography and climate is for so many communities in need.
So I just got a big sign delivered to me that time's up. So what I want to say is just three things. Just to remember that CRS represents all of you out in the world. And the work we do is really a response to the call of the gospel to be where people need help. And the third and final thing we want to say is that we recognize actually this type of service is a privilege. It's a tremendous privilege to understand that these people whom we're helping, they're sent to us by God, that we also are sent by God, and that this is basically how the world, the kingdom of God, is supposed to operate, is people helping other people. We take it very seriously. We are very good stewards. 92 cents of every dollar we receive go into the field, understanding that the money is not for us. But the most important thing is to bring our very best game. And it's not just about working hard, it's about working smart. It's about constantly challenging ourselves to say whether the solutions we are providing really makes people's life better. And at CRS, we ask people to help us in four ways: plaque, pray, learn, act, and give. Thank you very much.
I'd like to thank Dr. Wu for sharing her thoughts, reflections, knowledge, and stories of serving the poor in our suffering world. Please take a moment to reflect on this, and it looks like we probably are not going to have time for questions, but we've been given so much information already. While we're doing that, our next First Friday Club luncheon will be December 4th with John Allen, Vatican correspondent and associate editor of the Boston Globe. His topic will be Pope Francis, Expect the Unexpected. We invite you to make us a regular part of your spiritual and intellectual growth. You can make reservations in several ways. You can send a check for $15 to the First Friday Club. The address is in the flyer. That would be for next month. You can call our phone number each month and sign up on a monthly basis, but please let us know by the Tuesday before the Friday talk. You can also reserve tickets online using our website. If you want to simplify your life, on the tables there are subscription sheets along with the schedule and options. Please take that form home with you and consider making our speaker series a consistent part of your spiritual and intellectual growth. You can also hear a podcast of previous speakers' presentations by logging on to our website. Please consider recommending that to a friend. We can also keep up to date by joining us on Facebook. For those of you who are new, please take time to fill out one of the orange information cards on the table. I hope they're there, that you can add to our email list and keep you apprised of our upcoming speakers. First of all, we'd like to recognize our first-time attendees, so please stand if you're here for the first time. Welcome, and please come back. Also, we'd like to recognize students, and I would ask them to stand, from Walsh Jesuit and Our Lady of the Elms. And, oh, I'm sorry, and we do have a few folks here from Archbishop Hoban. I'd also like all the board members of the First Friday Club to please stand. These folks do a lot of work to keep this organization going and provide these speakers and programs. So would all the First Friday Club board members please stand? I'd like to introduce Father Dave Durkee, pastor of Queen of Heaven Parish, who will give our closing prayer.
And before that short closing prayer, I wanted to say this. This summer I had the privilege of a week-long bicycling vacation in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. It was organized by the Bicycle League of Michigan, anyways, and I was one of the last, and there was just 187 of us biking for a week long, and anyways, I ended up at the end of the line, you know, I'm not quite in the shape I used to be. Well, there was these two college girls that were riding alongside of me, and one of them had a backpack on her back that had a pin that said the Peace Corps. And in conversation, I said, "Oh, you're in the Peace Corps." She said, "Yes, I for 3 years I've spent in Africa in the Peace Corps," and I was praising her for that work. And then I asked, "Did your Christian faith motivate you to be a Peace Corps member?" She said, "No." She says, "I'm an agnostic." And then somehow I let her know that I was a priest. I wasn't dressed like one on the bike, but and she said, as soon as I said that, she says, "The Catholic Relief Services are very visible there in Africa where she was spent her 3 years." So I just want to let you know that's an awesome gift that we're given to the world, that we're witnessing our faith, even to agnostics, or whatever religion, or no religion. And when we think about, when we meditate on the mysteries of the Rosary, the first two, the Annunciation, the Visitation, as soon as Jesus came into the womb of Mary, what did she do? She visited her cousin Elizabeth. The love of Christ calls us to love one another. And we thank you, Mary, for your witness as a great disciple of Christ. And we ask your prayers to be joined with us as we say, "Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen."
Thank you, Father Dave, and he was a last-minute recruit, so God bless him for doing that for us. I want to thank everybody for coming, and a reminder that next month, after many, many years, will be our last First Friday Club of Greater Akron at the University of Akron. We will be moving for the future to Tangier, just up the road on West Market Street, beginning in January of 2016. So we hope to see all of you here next month for our First Friday Club with John Allen. There should be, I hope, a shuttle available outside for those of you that had to park farther away, and that should be available to take you back if you so choose and would prefer not to walk. But everyone have a safe travels, and once again, thank you to Dr. Wu for her wonderful and inspiring presentation.